AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
I'm Tom Foti in Washington, where the Republican leader of the U.S. Senate, Mitch McConnell, has been hospitalized. Word of that came from a spokesman in late evening, but with very few details. Just that Senator McConnell was attending a private functions at a local hotel in Washington, and he tripped and fell. McConnell's 81. He took a serious spill about 3 years ago. He then suffered a shoulder fracture. In practical terms, it is little more than a suggestion that Congress will likely change big time, but President Biden today spells out his proposed federal spending priorities.
The White House says the president's budget will call for an increase in taxes on individuals making more than $400,000 a year to bolster the Medicare Trust Fund and reduce annual deficits by nearly $3 trillion over the next 10 years. The proposals will be dead on arrival in the GOP-controlled House, but the way the White House sees it,
the American people support what we're doing, and there is a choice to be made.
Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the public in particular backs tax increases on the wealthy. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, Washington.
About a month after that Ohio train derailment that still has residents of the East Palestine area much worried about air and water quality, the CEO of Norfolk Southern testifies today before a Senate committee. CBS News learns he will promise Congress his freight rail company is going to invest in more high-tech safety measures. Greg DeYoung is an associate professor of operations management at Southern Illinois University. He has doubts.
A lot of accidents that occur, and especially the worst ones, which involve passenger vehicles or pedestrians, those are happening at low speed, and all of these technological solutions aren't really going to help in that case.
It is a really old question. Can money buy happiness? Well, maybe, but these days it would take more than it used to. Correspondent Matt Piper.
New findings suggest that for most people, happiness does improve with higher earnings.
Money.
Earnings of up to $500,000 a year. That new number comes from a Nobel Prize-winning economist and fellow researchers. One of them did research on the topic back in 2010, and the study back then found money boosted happiness with $75,000 in annual earnings.
From Ukraine, word of another Russian missile barrage with at least five people reported killed.
Air raid warnings in 13 Ukrainian regions heralded yet another night of missile attack. Air defense systems were in operation before dawn in the capital, Kyiv. The governor of Kharkiv said a private residential building and critical infrastructure had been hit by about 15 strikes on the city and surrounding area.
Reporter Kat Wiener of the BBC. In Israel, protests intensify against a government plan to overhaul the independent judiciary. This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance so you only pay for what you need. Liberty Mutual.
The SHA 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Butler to Windlake. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Republican state lawmakers are blocking a new state policy covering shots for meningitis and chickenpox. The Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules voted along party lines today to suspend the rules through April of next year. The rules were enacted to safeguard the public, but Senator Steve Nass says they placed undue burden on parents. Sounds like Governor Evers' plan to pay for upkeep at American Family Field is a non-starter. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he doesn't see a path forward. Evers wants the state to spend $300 million to keep up the ballpark and keep the Brewers in Milwaukee. Voss says he hopes Republicans will come up with something else. In sports, Marquette beat St. John's in overtime in the Big East Tournament 72-70. The Golden Eagles take on the winner of UConn and Providence tomorrow night. The Bucks host Brooklyn tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
It's a whole new game with the Civic Media Network and our local stations carrying coverage of Marquette men's basketball in the Big East Conference Tournament. Play gets underway this Thursday when the number one seeded Golden Eagles tip off at 11 a.m. against the winner of the St. John's University Butler matchup.
Catch all the action on WXCO 1230 a.m., 98.9 FM in Wausau.
In the Nakusa area, dial up WIRI 105.5 FM. Every step of the Big East Tournament. Find Marquette on these local Civic Media radio stations and on the Civic Media app.
You're looking for real one.
We
have to really understand how critically important a time this is. Time for talk is over. The time for action is now. Because my voice has always been and will continue to be for people who don't have a voice.
Tune in to the Earl Ingram Show every Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Only on WAUK 540 AM, 101.1 FM, The Shaw.
I'm looking at the phone lines. I'm seeing some familiar faces. Wants to remind a Gina Beauclair.
Well, welcome back, Matt. I really miss you. We've been missing getting woke every morning, but now we'll get woke in the afternoon.
Wants to remind a Andrew of Detroit.
Professor, it's so nice you're back. We missed you during your vacation, and I'm very happy to be in your class for the semester.
Thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate all my callers.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM, Wisconsin's home for rational talk radio. A progressive voice for rural Wisconsin, WAUK 540 AM, always streaming at WAUK Radio.
A minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you remember the other day we were talking about, you know, advances in workers' ability to get a little flexibility, more life-work balance. In fact, you know, as I said the other day, I think Democrats need to stand up and take a much stronger view of what the future is going to be. If Tucker Carlson can come out and say we should not have automated trucks because it's bad for high school-educated men who are overwhelmingly employed in that industry, which I wholeheartedly support. Who knew I agreed with something with Schmucker Carlson? Democrats should be picking up on this and moving in a direction. And I talked about this idea of a four-day work week. Been talking about this for years. Finally, in my state of Pennsylvania, got a couple of guys who are going to be moving on this idea. Again, devil in the details, and we'll find out about it. And that's why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Dave Madsen and State Representative Joshua Siegel to come talk with us. Guys, appreciate the time.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with you, Dave. First and foremost, how'd this come to you? Why now? Why is this important?
Yeah, so like as you said in your previous comments, this is not necessarily a new idea. It's been talked about for some time. You know, we know each other, Rick, from I came out of the AFL-CIO, Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, as a community service and education director. And in the labor movement in Pennsylvania, we've been talking about a four-day work week for some time. I think what initially triggered this conversation and specifically looking into this specific legislation was when the New York Times released an article a few weeks ago saying that a pilot study was done in the United Kingdom, and roughly around 60 businesses participated, and it was a 6-month trial period, and the overwhelming majority found that a 4-day work week increased productivity, helped with retention rate, and also showed that workers felt their mental health improved and their overall health improved as well. So that sent off some alarm bells, or not alarm bells, but a lot of interest for me. And I was happy to sit next to my colleague, Representative Pielli, who's also working with Rep Siegel and I on this. And we were just talking shop on the House floor. And I said, you know, hey, what are some bills you're interested in working on? And he said, well, I'm looking into a 4-day work week. And I said, I just saw that study. And we decided we'd want to work on it. And then we found out Representative Siegel was also interested in working on it as well. And that's we started collaborating on this. It's very early stages. But right now we're optimistic. It's gaining a lot of buzz. This is our third you're the third media outlet to want to talk about this, and we've only been really working on it for a few weeks. So that means that there's some momentum, there's a lot of interest, and we're excited to talk about it. I'll let Rep Siegel chime in.
Yeah, no, that study is important because, you know, who knew happy workers would be more productive? Wow, who knew? Josh, you know, I want to get your thoughts because, again, this is to me,
Democrats need to be the party of working people. And this, again, is another one of those things I think you can take to voters and go, look, this is what we're working on. We're working on making lives better. And I think a four-day work week, you know, giving people the opportunity to have a better life-work balance is something most certainly that we should be able to deliver.
Yeah, you know, and for me, I'm a proud Labor Democrat, and I think that we need to be aggressive, bold, and audacious about advancing the cause of working folks. And I think, you know, I really want Pennsylvania to be a sort of a standard bearer. You know, we're the Keystone State, and I want us to sort of be at the keystone of redefining what it means to be a worker in America. And I think if you ask the average person that's working a 9-to-5 or, you know, is on the factory line, the thing that they'll tell you is that they're overworked, they're burnt out, and they're tired. And frankly, we as Americans tend to define ourselves by the work we do. And I think that that's backwards. I think that we should define ourselves by the free time we have with our family, you know, the ability to focus on the things that matter most, time with our kids, times with our loved ones. You know, I mean, we are all given a finite amount of time on this planet, and we should not spend it, you know, exhausted, tired, and burnt out. Our work is not really, you know, we work as a means to survive, but it should not be the thing that defines our lives. And you know, the interesting thing about the study in the UK was, you know, workers that, you know, had the 4-day work week were, you know, 40% of them said they were more likely to take up new hobbies. They were more likely to exercise, more likely to focus on their mental health. And really, as a society, I think, you know, we're sick. We work ourselves to death. You know, it's why part of the reason we're on antidepressants and so many folks are, you know, are finding outlets that are often unhealthy because we're burnt out as a country, as workers. And we've gotten a raw deal for decades where, you know, we work more and more hours for less and less pay. And so I think we really need to redefine that balance and set the standard and say, you know, you want good workers, you want people to be happy to work at your company. Well, you need to make sure they have dignity and respect and that they can actually live their life. And as you said, lo and behold, not a surprise, they're happy as hell to work for a company that actually respects their free time and they put in more work and they get a better product. When they actually have some time and they know that they've got an extra weekend, you know, a longer weekend to be with their loved ones, their kids, their, you know, to go hiking, to enjoy nature, to take up a new hobby. I mean, that's the stuff that really enriches life. And it's, you know, not the 9-to-5 that you punch in and punch out of.
Yeah. One of the things I found interesting in that study is it said that fathers were able to spend 27% more time with their children. Because they were commuting 27% less. So the time that they were spending going back and forth to work, they were actually able to spend with their children and spend with their kids, which I think is incredible. As a father of three, I would love to have more time with my kids. So Dave, let me go to you then, because, you know, obviously this is all great. Sounds great. Sounds fabulous. A 4-day work week. What are the chances of, let's start first, getting it through the Pennsylvania legislature? I think it'll go through the House because Democrats now control the House. Congratulations for the first time in quite a long time. But the Senate, much like a lot of times, the place where good ideas go to die. Any thoughts on how this gets maneuvers through something like that?
Yeah. So first, one thing I'll say is not necessarily a guarantee it would just pass the House because it's Democrat controlled. We have a big, diverse caucus. We had a orientation earlier this week where we went and did a deep dive on how diverse it is. We have anything from progressive Democrats to some more conservative Democrats. So first, we got to get consensus amongst our caucus. I think we can get there. The conversations preliminary we've had have been positive. But, you know, a lot of my colleagues have said, well, first, let's devil's in the details here, Dave. Let's get some finite details and present it to us. And, we'll kind of go from there. But I am confident we can come up with some sort of compromise that gets it through the House. Look, I mean, the truth is if the governor earlier in his address mentioned he wanted to bring more jobs to Pennsylvania. Well, frankly, if you want to bring more jobs, you need workers. And right now, in my district in the Harrisburg region, for every one worker, there's two jobs. We have a workers deficit. So right now we need to find innovative ways to attract workers to Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania struggled with brain drain for a long time, meaning people born here from here get educated here, but then they go to other places. And frankly, I think if we're going to attract particularly millennials and Gen Z that are talented, that are living in a major metro area and Washington, D.C., New York, you know, there's a lot of beautiful things in Pennsylvania and a lot of nice communities, but they may need some convincing. And I think employers, if they want to recruit top talent, may have to look at something like this. This incentivizes and helps them do that.
Right.
It gives them a tax credit. So it offsets any costs that they may incur. If say like they're in a industry where, hey, if they have a person working less one day, that might mean less revenue. This makes up that difference for them. And again, it goes back to the fact that workers are more productive. These companies that have done this are making money. So it's a win-win. I think Representative Siegel really nailed it on the head with just some of the moral aspects to this as well, that it just will make workers happier and live better lives. So I think what we have to hone in when we negotiate with the Senate is that this is a business-friendly piece of legislation. It's not a mandate. This is an incentive-based program. It's not forcing any employers to do it. And it would give them a subsidy in order to do this. And we can show through the studies that we've had that they'll make money off of it. And it will. And the other thing is, as we know, employers don't necessarily do a real good job of measuring when they have turnover. Turnover is one of the most expensive things that can happen to a business. A lot of times the focus is on high wages and benefits, but high turnover is a high cost to businesses as well. So if this addresses high turnover, helps them recruit talent, and gets them more money, I think it's a no-brainer. And I think if the business community, if we can get their support and they've signaled that they are interested, and we've had some positive conversations thus far, I think the Senate will work with us on it and pass the legislation.
So, Josh, let me ask you, because, you know, in looking, I know you're just working through the details. I want to know what the vision of this is. You know, are we talking about 4 10-hour days, 4 8-hour days? Are we talking about a shorter work week? Because I'm an advocate of starting looking at some of our antiquated labor laws. And, you know, much like the 8-hour day of the past, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will, we need it. Labor needs a new mantra. To get people more time at home. So a 4-day work of 8 hours is a time cut. How are you envisioning that this is going to work out? Will this be 4 days, 4 8-hour days for 5 8-hour days pay? You know, how do you envision this?
Well, I think that the goal is to make sure that it doesn't come at the expense of workers, that, you know, we're not rolling back their hours and then rolling back their pay. The idea is that, you know, they're going to put out more work than they've probably ever put out before because they're happier, healthier, and more motivated. But they're going to be working less hours. You know, I mean, I think the UK study looked at, you know, a 32-hour work week. You know, look, the 40-hour work week is a relic of a completely different time period when you had to be, you know, on the factory floor for a sustained period of time, and it was this output kind of mindset. But the reality is, you know, the economy has changed, and it is important, I think, that we are unified as a caucus and as an from an ideological perspective around making sure that the workday gets shorter, that we experiment with, you know, how long the individual workday itself needs to be. I mean, I think there's a lot of research out there about the fact that, frankly, a lot of time spent at the office is a lot of wasted time. You know, it's the water cooler talk, it's the surfing the internet. I mean, if companies actually really did a deep dive on the amount of time that workers were sort of just filling the day, I think they'd be pretty shocked at, you know, how few hours are really needed to get the stuff you need to get done.
Yeah.
And how much time they really could actually be at home. I mean,
I think I'm struggling with that one, Josh. I think I'm struggling with, you got lazy workers who are just hanging around and we're paying them, because I know some employers, well, we need to get in there and crack the whip and get those people working.
Yeah, well, no, I don't think that they're lazy. I think it's that we expect that we create these really arbitrary work days. You know, we say you got to be there for 8 hours. And the reality is that, you know, people are pretty damn efficient and pretty freaking productive. But, yeah, you know, all of a sudden you've got this 8-hour day and you wind up trying to fill it with work. You wind up trying to keep yourself busy a lot of the time. And I think we need to give workers credit that they can manage their own time. They know how to get their job done. They're good at what they do. They are motivated. But I think we, you know, we need to understand that the 40-hour work week as it stands, you know, you wind up spending a whole heck of a lot of time trying to fill your day, and you know what I mean? I'm not saying workers are lazy.
I wasn't saying that, but I can hear an employer going, they're just doing nothing. We got to get out there and crack the whip.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I think it's important to recognize that, you know, when you just arbitrarily say, you know, you got this 8-hour day. It's a carryover from a completely different type of industry, a completely different type of mindset. You know, the reality is that those workers wind up trying to, you know, you got to fill that 8-hour day. You got to look busy when you've gotten your work done. You've done your job. You know, you've been productive. You've got your output. you know, you should be now rewarded with, you know, good pay and the chance to, you know, go see the fruits of your labor and get a chance to, you know, take a vacation, go home, you know, go out to dinner with your loved one or whatever. That's what I think about. I certainly don't think any worker is lazy. And I think companies need to recognize that they force this kind of mentality on their workers and that they're sort of, that's where a lot of the misery comes from. You know, you're sitting at your office and you're like, hey, I'm done. I did what I needed to do.
Yeah, I could be why doing something still... better. No, you're right.
Right. Well, why can't I go home?
No. Empowered workers are always going to be much more productive. Dave, you wanted to jump on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to Rep Siegel's point. It's the truth is what happens, I think, with a lot of workers, and I've dealt with this in my life, is let's be honest, a lot of resources and services that you need are open at 9 to 5 or, you know, 8 to 4. Say if you have to go to the bank or go take your car to the shop. Yeah, you have personal time or sick days to address a lot of these things. But frankly, I think people in day-to-day life just need more time to do. It's not necessarily just relaxing, just life.
Yeah,
adult
to do life. Yeah,
definitely.
You know, go to the grocery store. We're at this stage now. I mean, it's a blessing that, you know, our parents are living to be 80 or 90. But folks around Jock or Rep Siegel and I's age, you know, we're raising kids and then we're also taking care of elderly parents. And if a modern family could sit down with your person and say, hey, we have an option of, you know, a 4-day work week and from both of our employers. Well, you take Mondays and then I'll take Friday off and we can split up the responsibilities in the household and take care of our families. And guess what? They're not going to be sitting there texting and figuring out daycare at work or sneaking away to call to talk to a bank teller because they need an extra credit line or whatever it is. These practical daily life things. I mean, I think that's a direct correlation with productivity. When you have less distracted workers, they're going to be more productive.
There's a whole bunch of reasons why this is a great idea. The only thing standing in the way is corporate America. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Pennsylvania State Representatives Dave Madsen and Joshua Siegel. We'll get links out on their website. You can take a look at their websites and the work that they do. But we're talking about the 4-day work week and the path here in this my state of Pennsylvania of how we get to that. Let me ask you, there are other, you know, other states across the are other states doing this? Is there any movement in other legislatures to do this kind of thing? Because I got to imagine that this is popular. Somebody's got to be moving it.
I know Maryland is taking action right now. I think they're the first state to pioneer this approach, and they're doing a very similar to what you know model to what we're proposing, which is the tax incentive based model to try and encourage businesses to explore this potential. And I think, you know, to Dave's point, to, you know, Rep Madsen's point, this is one of those instances where the interest of workers and businesses actually really align here. I think there's an opportunity for buy-in from both sides. You know, the COVID epidemic and the Great Resignation has really just sort of scrambled the business model. You've got hybrid work and businesses are trying to adapt as quick as they can. And this is one of, I think, those really smart innovations that, you know, businesses are going to start to recognize, because it is about attracting workers. It's about making sure, especially that the next generation of workers who value flexibility a lot more than they do compensation a lot of the time, they really want to make sure that they've got that free time. You're not going to be the workforce of tomorrow. You're not going to be the employer of tomorrow unless you are, you know, you are adopting these proposals. And that was one of the things that COVID did, is it reset the worker dynamic. It gave workers a lot more power to shop around for jobs, to demand more from their employers in terms of flexibility. I think this is that next sort of natural evolution. And I think the best thing that states can do is help push that along and force that mindset change by being a partner. This is a really, like, you know, it's a tax incentive. It's a collaborative effort to get businesses to embrace that mindset. I think they'd be foolish not to.
I agree with you. But let me ask you this, Josh, because, you know, my view on this is I want to get to the 32-hour work week. I want to get to a shorter work week because I know what's coming. We've all read the economic forums, you know, predictions for the future. Half of the jobs we currently do are going to be done by computers or AI, or we're going to be losing a lot of jobs, but we're going to be gaining some as well. The number of man hours is going to go down. People need jobs. It seems like a shorter work week gives more opportunities for more people to have those jobs. So it seems like to me the future is still employment, that people, you know, get their health care, because we're stuck on this. that this is a way to make sure that workers don't take it on the chin when technological advances wipe out millions of jobs. I'm curious if you see this as part of that.
Yeah. Well, to your point about, you know, the necessitation of more workers, right? So I think the story of, you know, the last few decades has been that companies have tried to put more and more work on less and less employees, right? They've tried to demand more from fewer folks. And I think when you create that 4-day work week and when you shorten the work day, companies are going to have to hire additional people to kind of spread the balance of the workload out. And I think that means you're creating more opportunities. And I don't think this is just something for high-tech jobs and the creative economy. I think if you work in a skills-intense industry, like in the trades, you know, this means that if you want to get a project done on time, you're going to have to hire more working-class folks to make sure that you're still making sure that they're getting that Friday or Monday off. It just means you're going to have more people on the job. And that's good because that's more money in the hands of working folks. That's, reducing the workload all around. I do think automation is probably going to be the most sort of decisive, but also destabilizing thing we have to contend with as a society. And I think this is one of those ways where we make sure we're creating opportunity by making sure that everybody's got a shot to still be a part of the economy in a productive way. And, you know, at least while our, you know, employer-based health insurance model exists, get access to the kind of benefits you can only really get from, you know, our employment-based model until hopefully as a society we can shift that to more of one of solidarity and then, you know, government-sponsored. But in the meantime, I agree with your assessment there. I think this creates opportunity because it compels employers to hire more folks.
Yeah, and for me, it also means that you guys as legislators are getting ahead of the technological catastrophe that's, you know, the tsunami of job losses that are potentially going to happen. And we do such a terrible job of legislating ahead of horrible. And we usually reactionary. So for me, this is the beginning of maybe starting to lay the groundwork. Do you agree, Dave? I mean, are you with me on this?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I think that we in this new economy, in the post-COVID economy, we're going to have to continue to have conversations like this around how do we adapt our workforce and our economy to growing technology, AI. That certainly is our future. It's not just going to be blue collar jobs. We're going to see loss through automation. It's going to be a lot of white collar work. I mean, frankly, what I saw during the pandemic teleworking is I think, you know, the software can manage and report how much a worker is, how many calls they're taking, how many cases that they're solving. You really need a middle management person at that stage. I agree. And listen, and my opinion is this, we have so much collective wealth in this country. And the technology has advanced so much. I don't think we all have to work as much as we're working and struggle as much as we're struggling. I think Rep Siegel nailed it on the head with his previous comments. I mean, we're advancing so much as a society now that I think we can afford and people can have an extra day to be with their families and loved ones. And that's, this is just one piece of many to adapt our workforce and economy, but I definitely think it will be a key component to it.
No, that's an important point because, you know, look, as technology takes over an industry, it gets away with, gets rid of people. It consolidates wealth and into the hands of a few. For me, we need these kind of redistributive policies that are going to help a working class survive, or we're going to have chaos. People need jobs. When Tucker Carlson comes out and says, we can't have automated trucks on the road because all of these high school educated white men aren't going to have jobs, that's a pretty definitive statement saying we're going to squash progress because of the social compact. And it's something that I think this is a part of. So last question I've got for you. You know, what can we do to help to get this move through? What can I do? Because I think it's important. What can our listeners do?
Dave, you want to take that, or I'm happy to hop on that?
Yeah, sure. I'll start it off and let you follow up. Look, I think right now is continue to monitor it. We will be follow our pages on social media and our websites. Once the bill, we have a final draft, we will be doing a press conference. We'll be putting out some editorials as well. Rick, if you can continue to circulate it through your network, I follow you on Twitter. I know a lot of folks follow you and listen to your show. So, you know, just continue to spread the word out. And once the legislation and bill is introduced, if you're a supporter of this stuff, just call your legislator and say, hey, I see that there's a 4-day work week proposal. I'd like you to consider a vote. Go to that office. Listen, reps, if they don't hear anything, they assume that, you know, hey, I guess nobody in my district cares. So, but if they get calls and people come into their office saying, hey, I need you on this, believe me, they will listen and pay attention.
Guys, I appreciate the time. We're out of time. I'd love to have you back as this continues down the road. This is really important, but I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Reps Dave Madsen and Joshua Sengel.
The Shaw 101 FM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. Emmy Award-winning actor Robert Blake has died at 89. His family says he'd suffered from heart disease. Blake started acting at a young age, here with Humphrey Bogart in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
The lottery, senor?
Beat it. I ain't buying no lottery tickets. Go on, beat it.
4,000 pesos, the big price.
Get away from me, you little beggar.
Later in life, Blake was charged with killing his second wife, Bonnie Lee Bakley, and was acquitted. Central and Northern California are wet. CBS's Steve Futterman.
A so-called atmospheric river is already dropping rainfall, which will also result in snow melting. Put together, officials in the state fear there could be dangerous floods and are warning residents to be careful.
Senators weigh in on along party lines on President Biden's almost $7 trillion budget proposal. Louisiana Republican John Kennedy says he didn't hear the specifics.
Any president's budget in modern times has become more of a messaging bill than anything else.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Bringing some sanity to the airwaves. The Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. Keep the shovels handy. Winter storm warning in effect for Kenosha, Milwaukee, Ozaukee, Racine, Sheboygan, Washington, and Waukesha counties. Beginning at 6 p.m. until 10 a.m. Friday with 6 to 8 inches of snow and possibly more along Lake Michigan. A winter storm watch also begins at 6 p.m. until 9 a.m. Friday for Dodge, Fond du Lac, Jefferson, and Walworth counties with 4 to 6 inches possible. The storm is expected to affect the Friday morning commute. Winter storm or not, it's sugaring season in Wisconsin. Wisconsin. Sap harvesting begins in February and runs until April. But March is considered the best time. Temperatures need to be below freezing at night and above freezing during the day. Wisconsin, the fourth largest maple syrup producer in the country, with over 400,000 gallons made last year. It takes 40 gallons of sap to make just 1 gallon of maple syrup. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripescast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which is audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
Wait a minute. How about this? Listen to me, you lantern-jawed cretin, you horned-eyed homunculus. You are going to do what's right for the people of Wisconsin. You're putting cans of water in our water, destroying the greatest university system in the country, and public education. Knock it off. That is unlikely to be said. That's what I'd say.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
With people like themselves.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today, President Biden came out with the budget, his budget. And again, you know, like all budgets, moral documents. What are your priorities? What do you want? How are you going to pay for it? That kind of stuff, that important kind of stuff. You know, because we want roads and bridges. We want education. We want a military. We want children to not go hungry. We want a lot of stuff. And how do you get to paying for it? And I think part of what the president came out with and the big thing that's getting the attention is taxing rich people. Who would have thought? And here to share some thoughts on whether it's a good idea, bad idea, or something we should be doing, you know, that tax the rich thing. The guy who actually wrote the book, Tax the Rich, our good friend Morris Pearl. He's the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be in your show, Rick.
So you, as the guy who literally wrote the book on taxing the wealthy, you got to be kind of happy, no?
Yeah. I mean, I'd be even happier if I was, you know, standing next to the president when he signed the bill and hands me the pen. And I'd be very happy if I was just watching it on TV. But having him on our side, that's a big step in the right direction. We've moved a huge way over the last, you know, 6 years. And I think that we're moving in the right direction. The president of the United States is with us on taxing the rich.
So what does that mean? What is that taxing the rich? What does that mean?
Well, what it means in this case, it was the billionaires' minimum income tax. If you have over $100 million in your investments, you're going to have to pay some taxes on the money you make, even if you don't sell your investments. If you make money that you can spend, you're going to have to pay a small amount of that in taxes, whether you sell them or not in the future. And that is going to make a difference. Part of the reason why we rich people are getting so rich is that we don't have to pay taxes on the money we make.
Right.
Until we, you know, feel like it.
Now, they're calling a billionaire minimum income tax, the BMIT. And as you point over, households over $100 million are talking about a 25% rate by taxing all income. And what does that mean? I mean, you know, because we keep hearing, you know, the rich dad, poor dad guy going, the dirty secret is rich people don't have any income. So if you have no income, how can you tax them?
If you're a billionaire, you don't need any income. You can spend the money you already have.
Right. So how do we tax them then if they have no income?
What we do is we look at their investments. And if they make money in their investments, we tax that and call it income.
Aha.
We do.
See, now that makes a lot more sense.
I think the president is making a lot of sense. We have a choice to make, Rick, as a nation. If we have to make one of two choices, we can either get rich people to sacrifice a little bit of their money and pay a bit more in taxes, or we can tell all the Americans who are retiring, who paid into Social Security all their lives, that they have to sacrifice and give up some of their Medicare. Frankly, I think the rich people are the ones who we should ask to sacrifice, not the Americans who've been working their whole lives and putting their money away.
Now, when I threw this idea that when the president put out his tweet saying, hey, you know, we're going to move on this, I said, hey, it's about time we start taxing rich people because we need that revenue to do all the things that you just said. Immediately you get the blowback. The rich people pay all the taxes. And, well, you know, when you look at the bare numbers, you know, when you go 50% of the people in this country, the bottom 50 pay, you know, a minuscule amount because they don't have anything. And the top half, you know, they pay all the 97% of the taxes. Their argument is, well, the rich people pay all it. But when you look at as it breaks down, the top 1% pays far more than everybody else, which, again, is very curious to me and why I think this billionaire minimum tax is so very important.
Well, they pay a lot of dollars because they're very rich. They don't pay a high percentage of the money they make. That's the thing, is that you and your staff pay a higher percentage of the money you make than rich people pay as a percentage of money they make.
Yeah.
And that's why the rich people are getting richer and richer and richer. And half the people in Western Pennsylvania are having trouble just hanging on and living paycheck to paycheck. That's the problem.
And interestingly enough, according to one tax agency, they said that the average federal tax rate paid by the average American in this country is about 14%. And to your point, the average billionaire now pays about 8%. So you're hitting right that note. It's a larger number, but it's a smaller percentage of income.
And the average truck driver is paying a lot more than 14%, I assure you.
I can attest to that. So in looking at this, you know, I go, this is great. The president has come out and brought out this great idea. We're going to start taxing rich people, and we're going to feed children. What could be a better statement? We're going to get some investment into the earned income tax credit so families can get out of poverty. What are the chances of this actually passing? When was the last time a president's budget actually got all the way through?
You know, I'm just saying, I don't even know the last time a president's budget actually passed. It may have been before I was born, but we're going to do what we can to get some of these ideas to move forward. It may take a year, it may take another election, but we're going to continue pushing. We've been pushing a long time, and we've got a pretty convoluted tax system right now, as you know. The Congress has come up with all kinds of rules that have to incentivize people to do things. And, oh, we need to incentivize people. And, you know, oh, we're afraid that these billionaire hedge fund managers might go on strike, so we have to give them a lower tax rate than everyone else. Maybe we should give, like, emergency room nurses a lower tax rate than everyone else. I think that's what I'm actually worried about, not a lack of people willing to do hedge fund management.
Or more importantly, maybe we take that tax that we're bringing in and we fund education so that emergency room nurse doesn't have a lifetime of student loan debt. You know, maybe we make investments in the future of this country without taking on massive debt so that the future has to pay off the past investments. I don't know, just a thought.
We can do that. We did that when I was young. I had all kinds of subsidies when I was a young person growing up and wanting to go to college. And now we've come up with this new idea that, oh, everyone should pay their own way and the rich people should be fine and everyone else, well, get student loans and spend your entire life paying them off. That's not fair. It doesn't work. It doesn't move our country forward. It doesn't give people opportunities that end up making our country have a better and bigger economy for everyone.
I think that's an important point to keep pointing out and repeat as often as possible. We are a wealthy country, and we are one of the wealthiest countries in the history of civilization at its wealthiest moment. There's almost nothing that we can't afford, and yet I keep hearing, Morris, we can't afford health care for our workers. We can't afford education for our kids. We can't afford infrastructure. We can't afford to make sure that no child goes to bed hungry. We can't afford to make sure that no veteran remains homeless. We keep being told there are all these things we can't do, but yet we can have billionaires with all kinds of wealth.
Because back in the 1980s, some guy with the stripes going the wrong way in his shirt came along and said, greed is good. And then, Americans voted for a guy who came along and said, the government is the problem, not the solution. And we have to change that. We have to say we're going to do things collectively, do things together. Do things collectively we can't do individually, and we will all be better off.
Yeah.
Every one of us.
So tomorrow, as this, because this, again, this is an important moment because this is the rallying cry for people who want to see investments. What are we advocating for people to do? I mean, look, I've been saying for a while, the bigger, it goes back to the days of the cave. The bigger your shoulders, the more water you carry back to the cave. The wealthier you are, the more society should expect from it, and the more you should want to do. This is the thing that gets me. And you walk in the circles of very, very wealthy people. They could have legacies, lifelong legacies. Jeff Bezos could end childhood poverty with a stroke of a pen, and his legacy would be he ended hunger in this country forever. And yet I don't see people thinking in terms of that kind of legacy.
I mean, we're just trying to organize our people. I'm the head of the group of the Patriotic Millionaires, and we're trying to organize our people to lean on their congressmen and their senators to support the president's efforts to, make a decision in favor of having the rich people be the ones to make some sacrifice and not all the people who've been working for a living their whole lives. And we can organize a bunch of rich people and investors to do that, and that's what we're trying to do right now.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Morris Pearl. Morris, the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, their website. Lots of resources there to take a look at. I want to get your thoughts on, you know, I look at someone like Elon Musk, who's now coming out. Evidently, they're going to build a company town. And I see a lot of the good old days of the 80s and 90s coming back up. This idea that we have benevolent dictators, we have rich people who have a vision of how they want things to go, and they're going to build towns and create jobs in those towns, and we know morality clauses and all kinds of stuff will follow. Do you see that this is, you know, potentially the direction we're going as wealth inequality continues to grow if we don't do something at some point very soon through our government?
If we don't do something about it, yeah. And I have nothing against Mr. Musk spending his money however he wants.
I have no problem with it either. My problem is, you know, I know how bad company towns were throughout the history for working people.
And we can't continue. I mean, there's company towns right now in West Virginia. I've been talking to people who say they're trying to get their government to provide running water, something I don't even think about. It's so obvious. And there's people who, you know, basically don't have any money at all because they get paid from their job, but they deduct for their rent for their house and their bill of their groceries, and they end up getting zero. And yeah, so that's not so good. If somebody wants to live in Elon Musk town, great, go for it, do it. But I don't think that's how everyone should live. And I think we should make decisions by a democratic process, by voting and electing people to make decisions, not by having a dictator, no matter how benevolent, making all the decisions for everybody. That doesn't work. I mean, it's not how I want to live. And I don't think it's how most Americans want to live.
Now, what do you say to the person who goes, Morris, you're advocating to tax the rich. In fact, you have written the book, Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer. And we'll get links on social media, how you can take a look at the book and pick it up maybe at the A place, or go to Powell's Books more specifically. What do you say to the person who goes, Morris, you want to pay higher taxes? Go ahead. Do what you do you. I don't want to.
Well, look, we can't run a country with everyone paying whatever they want. You couldn't run a country club and say, oh, everyone just send in whatever money they want to. It wouldn't work. You have to set the dues for the country club so you have enough money to pay the groundskeepers and pay the dining room staff and do all the things your country club does. You can't run a country that way either. We have to have rules, and the same rules that apply to everybody. And if people are going to, we're going to ask people that work every day to send in 20% of their income, then we have to ask the rich people that make money sitting and watching the numbers on their computer screens to send in 25% of their income too. We have to have the same rules for everybody.
No, I'm right there with you. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because there's clearly now differences between the red hat and the blue hat. You know, I keep hearing people, oh, the politicians, they're all the same. Biden has come out with his plan. We're going to raise taxes on millionaires, have a progressive tax. We're going to invest in making sure that kids don't go hungry and doing the things that we had talked about, you know, raising, you know, corporate taxes a little bit, both domestically and internationally. And the Republican plan of, we're just going to slap a national sales tax of 30% on everybody, on everything you buy. There are two very competing visions for the future. Do you see it any other way?
We are at a crossroad. And yeah, 30% sales tax and everything, that'll mean me paying a lot less taxes than I do now, I assure you. 30% tax on everything, someone who's living paycheck to paycheck, that'll mean a lot more taxes for them. And if you want to shift the burden and give more money to the rich and less money to people who are working for a living, then that's the Republican plan. If you think that people who work for a living should get health care and not have to pay any more tax than they do now, and the rich people should pay a little more, that's the president's plan. You have a clear choice in front of you. There's clearly a difference between the two sides, and it's up to Americans to make a decision.
Again, it's the classic, which side are you on? Interesting stuff. Morris, as always, I appreciate your insight and your input. Good stuff. Keep up the great work there at Patriotic Millionaires. I look forward to having you back again next week.
Thank you. See you next Thursday, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend Morris Pearl. Check out their website, patrioticmillionaires.org. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Think Tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. You've likely heard the recent news stories about the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. The national media continues to report as labor, energy groups, environmental, and Native American activists all debate the proposed pipeline. But did you know that on this day in labor history marked the beginning of another oil pipeline project? The year was 1974, when work began on the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline System. In the early 1970s, the United States faced an energy crisis as international oil prices skyrocketed. The Alaskan Pipeline Project was started as a means to address the crisis, although many in the environmental movement protested the idea. Tens of thousands of workers flocked to Alaska. Towns along the oil line boomed overnight. The population of the town of Valdez more than quadrupled from 1,500 to more than 6,000 in just 1 year. A two-bedroom log cabin without indoor plumbing could rent for as high as $500 a month. In Fairbanks, demand for space by workers was so high, workers had to rent bed space. In addition to the high costs, workers also had to endure the harsh cold. Todd Honer, a pipeline laborer, described the experience. When you're working at night on the North Slope, the wind is usually blowing, the snow is usually blowing, communications is marginal, and the smoke from the diesel engines, the cold, the chaos. It was surreal, and we continued that for 10, 12 hours. And I am sure by the end of every night, everybody wanted to quit and just go home. Many more workers did not even get the chance to brave the cold, as more workers arrived than there were available jobs. Those who had arrived too late to land a job had to return home disappointed, while others never made it home at all. During its construction, the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline took the lives of 32 workers. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Interestingly enough, got a couple of comments from folks saying a company town in this day and age wouldn't be a bad thing. And again, it comes back to this idea, this ideology, this tribe thing. You know, I want people who are just like me. I want carbon copies of me. I want to live next door to me. And I'm like, seriously, you want to live next door to yourself? I don't know. You can be pretty annoying. But, you know, it's one of these things where I go, this idea that we're going to have homogenous communities, that I'm only going to associate with people who are exactly like I am and think exactly like I do, and never shall we have, you know, divergent thought processes. You know, the workplace is where, you know, where we worked a lot of this stuff out. And as I've said before, the reason to have strong labor unions is that we deal with a lot of these issues in the workplace. And workers deal with them among themselves. And, you know, again, this idea. I'm struggling with the idea of people wanting to be part of company towns. The idea that one person. And look, there are these places around the country. There are a lot of them. They're called cults. A lot of the religious leaders have their own little towns where you have to sign on to these morality pledges. You go back to, you know, the Henry Fords of the world, that if you wanted to work for his factory, they would come and inspect your home. And you had better have the right things in your home. You know, a picture of him over the mantle, the Bible. You better be leading a virtuous life. This is where we're heading. It seems like we're heading back to. The Puritan police are coming for us. And whether you're doing things that you find objectionable or not, or you think someone else, doesn't matter. Because it's that, eventually they're going to get around to you. The idea that we're all in the shark tank and eventually the shark runs out of people to be outraged by. And then it's you. My problem with the kind of power and control in the hands of so few is that we get abuse all the time. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And these company towns have proven throughout history to be horrible for working people, as these cults have. And I find it interesting that it's my religious zealot class, my religious zealot friends, who are the most willing to say, no, no, we need to have, you know, a community just for us, people who think like we do, so we can ostracize the other. Now, understand, this is the brilliance of what the benevolent dictator understands. Because we can pit each other against each other on those things. You'll be around people just like you, people dumb enough to think this is a good idea. This way I can work you to death and profit off of your labor. And you'll just keep going because, hey, you're surrounded by people just like you. No one will ever ask a question like, are we getting screwed here? Could we make more money? Should our kids have better opportunity? Could we get better health care? Can I go shop at a store across the way? As long as you're willing to walk in that straight line, and I'm not talking about people's sexuality, as long as you're willing to walk on that line and never deviate, these company towns are fabulous. All of your needs are taken care of. Until they're not. Oh, the Pullman situation was a perfect example. Question is when do we wake up and realize that we're the frogs in the pot and the water's boiling? The zealots are legislating in state after state, legislating morality, privatizing education, banning books again. We're banning freaking books again. It's all of that horrible that I read about as a kid. And I keep coming back to, you know, like the book 1984, I always joke, two people read it. One person goes, oh my God, it's a horrible, horrible thing. Who would ever want to live like that? And the other person looks at it and goes, wow, this is a great playbook. We should do this. And there's part of me that goes, that's how you decide, I guess, which side politically you're on. You know, which hat you wear. The hat of free expression and liberty, pursuit of happiness, or the side of I'm only going to be around people who think exactly like I do and believe that that is somehow freedom and liberty. The idea that somehow having only people who have the values that I have, and some of them may be really freaking twisted, but they think like I do. You know, they're like me. That's scary, because we then lead to all kinds of the other negatives that we've seen throughout history. And I'm a little worried, because I look at the Lauren Boebert thing, and the Lauren Boebert thing is interesting to me, because the zealot class gives her a pass, because, you know, her baby's not gonna allow his baby to be aborted. No siree. She's a strong champion. Yet, if I still remember the conservative movement, you know, going after women for not taking care of their children. You know, as a mother, where was she? Their ideology, their company town-esque behavior and beliefs kind of break down. It's always the do as I say, not as I do mentality. And, you know, listening to Lauren Boebert talk about, and this is a digressing, talking about her, you know, saying we should do away with sex education, someone who was, you know, knocked up as a teenager, unmarried, probably not something someone you should not be listening to. In fact, she should be the cautionary tale of why we should have the other option. Choose the other option. And I think this is where we are. we're in that, which side are we on? Like when I was talking about Morris, we're in the tax situation. Which side? You tax the wealthy or 30% tax on everybody? Which side are you on? Going to be interesting to see how it plays out from an observer's point of view. Fun to watch. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, I want to hear them. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.